The California Council of Community Behavioral Health Agencies is an association of organizations dedicated to providing mental health and substance use disorder programs and services to those in need across the state. In partnership with the American Leadership Forum, our conversation features Dr. Leandra Clark Harvey, the Director of Policy and Legislative Affairs, next on Studio Sacramento.
For over 20 years, Five Star Bank has created thoughtful solutions to help the Capital Region thrive. From economic development and education to public health and safety, issues that are vitally important to Sacramento's prosperity. We're proud to be part of the conversation and hope you'll join in.
Leandra, Governor Newsom has made a big commitment on improving mental health in California.
Most definitely.
So much so that he appointed a czar to essentially go on a listening tour and find out what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. If this czar were with us today, what would you tell them that needs to be done in order to elevate and improve the level of mental health for all Californians?
Well, Scott, I think that's an excellent question. Dr. Tom Insel is the czar, and he really is focused on behavioral health and really transforming the system here in California, and it's incredibly timely. As you mentioned, the governor is very focused on behavioral health. And so if he was here, I'd love to talk to him about accountability. There is funds that are set aside for mental health treatment and provision, namely Proposition 63 Mental Health Services Act funds. Yet across the years, there's been a lot of scrutiny on how those funds are utilized at the county level, at the state level. And so I would encourage Mr. Insel to look at how those funds are utilized to put in greater accountability measures so that the public can feel that there's more transparency.
What's not happening with accountability right now?
I think that there's a feeling sometimes and questions about how funds are actually being spent. Are they being spent in the spirit of the act? And I know that the Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission has done its best to make sure that that happens.
Give us an example of how money is being spent, where it is that it might not be completely in alignment with the spirit of the act itself.
Well, the Mental Health Services Act has different components to it. For example, one component is PEI, or Prevention and Early Intervention Services. So there may be feelings among service providers and patients and families that are supposed to benefit from the funds that there might not be enough money spent in one category or the other, or maybe the funds are not basically impacting the community at the level that they need to be. Folks really are looking for programs that are funded or not funded. I think that part of the difficulty too is that every county is different. We have 58 counties and 58 ways of providing services and doing things. And that makes sense because counties have different needs and different structures, different struggles. But I think if there is a better way of finding measures and creating measures to be so the counties can be more accountable, that would be the goal. And I think that a lot of folks are interested in that. It's not an easy task at all.
California has been known across the country, at least over the past 15, 20 years, as a leader in speaking to mental health issues and actually putting more dollars behind mental health services.
Sure.
At the same time, it seems like there's a continual deluge of new conditions or new populations that are needing mental health services. Why is it that it feels like we can't get in front of really making progress?
Wow, that's a really big question. And I think that part of the issue is there are restrictions on how some of the funds are set aside and the populations that they can be used for. And so I think when that trickles down to communities, it feels like some folks aren't being served in the best ways that they can. Add on top of that, just stigma. You know, that's not a California issue, but it's definitely seen here.
Stigma, tell us a little bit about that.
Stigma is experienced by all communities, but I see it as a former practitioner. I've seen it most evidently happening in racial and ethnic minority and other disenfranchised communities. The feeling like you shouldn't seek mental health or behavioral health services, that it's not okay to talk about it, that it's really taboo. That's something that's very prevalent.
Where does that come from?
I think, you know, when you talk about racial and ethnic minority and diverse and disenfranchised populations, it comes from the culture. It comes from what's passed down from you. If you come from a family where this just isn't talked about, it's not okay, you're not going to talk about it. You're not going to raise your kids to talk about it or acknowledge it. Also, it's a lack of information, really not understanding. Some communities believe that it's a defect if you have a mental illness or something is wrong with you spiritually. Those cultural factors can really impact help-seeking behaviors.
Does that cascade down to even how it is that children access services? For instance, in like a school-based environment where it is that a child may be struggling in terms of behavioral issues within the classroom and things like that, and that then is impacted because the parents coming from whatever background because of the stigma issue, won't access services that are even put out there for them, assuming that they're there.
Yeah, for sure. I think that you're pointing to something that is very problematic, right? So school is a natural catchment area and place to be able to deal with a lot of different issues, particularly mental illness and substance use disorder issues as well. Everything shows up at schools. Some of my best moments were at school. Some of my worst moments were at school. The day after my parents divorced, I went to school and I talked about it with friends and teachers. So schools need to be better equipped to provide the services. And I do agree that if you come from a family that doesn't talk about mental illness or substance use disorder, you're not going to know what it is. You're not going to know to reach out to a guidance counselor. And that's why I feel like the school personnel needs to be equipped to recognize signs and symptoms of a mental illness, of a short-term crisis, et cetera. But I think, yes, that's why some students don't recognize and don't know where to go. And I feel that the onus falls on the schools to be able to have the right personnel there.
Well, in talking about schools, one of the issues that has really captivated the media over the past couple of years has been violence that have happened in school places. And it always seems like that there's the same pattern where there's a child who presents either, you know, behavioral characteristics of alienation, isolation, things like that. And in hindsight and retrospect, everyone says that they see it, but yet nothing happens. What is it that we as society are not necessarily doing right in order to address those individuals and get them the care that they need before something else happens?
Well, it's interesting you say that because you'll hear a lot, and as you're saying, there's a lot of media attention and coverage on, you know, the folks that commit crimes and are part of these violent acts. Maybe they had a mental illness or behavioral health disorder. But when we look at the facts and figures, that's actually not the case. The majority of these folks did not have a mental or behavioral health disorder. And I think the temptation is to link.
Yeah. Wait a minute. They didn't?
No. And I think it gets sensationalized. And the temptation is to link someone's behavioral and mental health disorder to violence. The link is not there when we look at the research. We do know that children who are exposed to violence and have a mental health condition, you know, there are issues there that need to be addressed. Again, I feel the school is a great place to try to address some of those issues. But I think we also have to be careful in some of the labels that we put on people, saying because you have a mental illness, you then are going to be a violent person. We know that that's not
so.
Causality.
Let me sort of give you the counterpoint to this. Wouldn't you say that a person who is going to school and then goes home, gets a weapon and goes to school and tries to hurt their classmates or the faculty, is suffering from a mental health issue of some sort?
In that particular scenario where the person happens to have a mental illness, it could be that that mental illness contributed to depression, anxiety, feelings of isolation, and that one way they acted out, unfortunately, is in a violent way. But I guess what I'm saying is that when you look at all of the different crises across the nation that have happened, that there's a tendency to link mental illness and violence, and it's just really important that we're clear that that link is not established.
A scientifically established
right.
link.
Right.
Then what does drive those sorts of behaviors in terms of, and maybe it's as unique as snowflakes mm-hmm. for every individual. Is what you're saying kind of that we're the tail's wagging the dog and that we're spending too much time focusing on, as horrific as these incidents are, that they're very, very small in number mm-hmm. and we're missing the boat on a bigger set of issues?
I definitely think so. I think exposure to violence, community violence, and other factors actually are much greater if you could predict someone's violent behavior. Mental health illness does not necessarily do that. And I guess that's just the point that I'm trying to make. But I do believe that for children that are experiencing depression, anxiety, any other, you know, mental health issue, that the school does need to be equipped to deal with that.
Getting back to the broader issue of sort of the state of mental health in California, you started out, I said the words mental health, mm-hmm. and you responded with the term behavioral health.
Yes.
Are they one and the same thing, or are they different?
Great question. So you'll notice that a number of organizations have changed their name from such and such mental health to such and such behavioral health. So the group that I work for, the California Council on Community Behavioral Health Agencies, was once mental health agencies. And the reason that changed is because there's a growing recognition that we're treating one person, whether or not they have a substance use disorder or a mental health issue, at the end of the day, all of that runs together and exists in one person. That's called comorbidity with diagnoses. And so I think in recognition of that, many folks have changed to behavioral health, understanding that you have to treat the whole person. And these things run together. Your substance use disorder, your alcoholism can, you know, cause depression or the other way around. But all of that exists within an individual. And so in order to move towards, you know, having a whole person perspective on treatment, we need to change our name, and we need to make sure that we're looking at all of those different aspects.
Is the reason we have such a hard time essentially treating behavioral health issues, I'll start to use the term that you share,
sure.
because of the fact that since it does have to do with the whole person, someone's state of behavioral health mm-hmm. According to what you just said, is linked to things like their geography, where they live in the community, yeah. their work environment, their mm-hmm. educational environment, their family environment, all mm-hmm. those things. That sounds so complex mm-hmm. that it defies essentially addressing someone with either a pill
sure.
or a therapy session.
Right. So the things that you mentioned are all part of the social determinants of health, right? And all of that interplays and impacts how we experience health.
All right, you're using a term that I need you to expand on, social determinants of health.
So social determinants of health, just like you spelled out workplace, community, health in general, all of those things play together and can impact a person and how they experience life. It impacts all of us, from the healthiest to the least healthiest person. And as we talk about mental health and substance use disorders, that is impacted by all of those determinants. So if you have access to, you know, water, housing, or not, that's going to impact your mental health. That's going to impact so much. If you live in a poor neighborhood, that's going to impact where your child goes to school or doesn't go to school. All of those determinants work together to determine what your health is or not.
When you're talking to clinicians and policymakers who are concerned with elevating and improving behavioral health in California. Mm-hmm. What are the two or three issues that are really at the top of the stack right now mm-hmm. that everybody's talking about or that people really want to take action on?
There's so many. But I would say the things that I'm hearing most about right now would be, one, the workforce crisis and shortage here, behavioral health workforce shortage.
I don't know about that. What is?
So there have been a number of reports released at the state level that established that we're in trouble. We have a lot of folks that need behavioral health services, but we don't have enough licensed clinicians to provide the services. And that's caused a movement to look at other ways of providing the services, non-traditional ways, like utilizing peers or people that are non-licensed or other allies in the health arena to provide complementary services to provide treatment. So that's something that's huge. And the governor has provided funding in his budget to help address this issue and to provide more training. We know that we have a paucity of psychiatrists and licensed clinicians too. So we have to look at really a comprehensive way to have not just the licensed clinicians and folks that specialized in behavioral health, but people like peer providers and substance use counselors and others that might not have a traditional license come together to address this issue. We have to be creative and we have to take a community approach.
That is fascinating. And there's support for taking an approach to bring in non-licensed providers as well?
There have been a lot of legislative attempts to do that. And I think that what that's done is it's opened up a conversation and have people really address the fact that we need to do more. What we have is not working. And if we really want to have folks get past stigma and seek help, the other issue is we have to have people there that are able to provide the services. And we know that we don't at this time. So workforce would be a huge issue that I think everyone can agree on.
Okay, so workforce is one. What else?
Well, as we were just talking about schools and mental health and behavioral health disorders in general, I think utilizing the schools to be able to bring in clinicians and partner with clinicians in the community to provide services on site, not just to the child, but also to the family. So often schools already have, you know, a school counselor or someone, they're overwhelmed. In addition, when a child goes on vacation or school is out, what happens to services? So it's important to also partner with community-based organizations that work 24/7, 365 days a year to provide services to youth and their families. So I think there's been a lot of focus on that partnership, communities and schools, and the governor has also been paying attention to that as well. He, in fact, had an allocation of $50 million to the Mental Health Services and Oversight Commission to provide money to fund school-community partnerships. So that's another area I hear about.
One other area that the governor has put an emphasis on is dealing with something that's called early childhood trauma and how it ripples through a person's life and trying to do interventions for folks.
Yes.
What is that? And what is, you know, what's the relationship between trauma that happens early on and sort of life trajectory, so to speak?
Yeah, the governor's focused on this, and this makes a lot of sense. He has appointed a surgeon general who's also very focused on this.
Is that a first for California?
It is. There's a couple things that are a first, a mental health czar and a surgeon general for our state. And she's very focused on trauma as well. And so there's been a number of legislative attempts to mandate clinicians' use of a test that's called ACEs, which is Adverse Child Experiences. And so there's a recognition that early trauma can impact your life trajectory. It can impact the decisions you make. It can impact your success many ways in life. And so if that's not dealt with and addressed early on, we know that the consequences are very serious. And so having a governor and a surgeon general and others who are really focused on assessing that and addressing that early on, I think is of great importance. And so I'm very supportive as a clinician. My agency I work for is very supportive as well. The state's going in the right direction there.
It's interesting because you do bring a clinician's background to the table. You're obviously very passionate about these issues. Mm-hmm. What is it that, in your own life experience, that led you to work in the behavioral health field? And really align yourself, not just as a clinician, but also as part of the advocacy community on these issues.
So my mom is a licensed marriage and family therapist, and she's been one for over 25 years. And it's interesting that I ended up being a psychologist because I swore early on that I would not be a mental health profession. I didn't know what I was going to be in life, but that's the one thing I was not going to be, because I saw the work that my mom did, and I really had a misconception of what seeking treatment was and mental health treatment was. I did, because my mom worked in settings where she provided services to folks that were pretty well off, who did not live in our neighborhood, did not have to necessarily deal with some of the issues that people around me had to. And so I just erroneously believed that mental health was for those that were privileged and of a certain race and class. And I,
not your own?
Not my own. And so even though my mother provided these services and worked well, I didn't see her serving a lot of Black people. I didn't see a lot of clients that, you know, came from our community, our church, our neighborhood. And so I assumed that it was something she did that was outside of who we were. And as I grew and I went to college, I had someone actually challenge me and say, well, you want to be a producer one day, and you want to be on the news, and you want to be the Oprah Winfrey. And how is that really helping your community? Because at the same time, you're talking about being so passionate about so much that you do and volunteering and helping people. And I had to think about it. So I took a psychology course, and it fit, and I've taken off ever since then. But that's how I got here. That's really where my passion is grounded.
And in your background, mm-hmm. and you're a child psychologist, mm-hmm. correct?
That's my focus.
That's your focus.
Yeah.
How does that, when you're in the settings of trying to advocate mm-hmm. for greater services, what are the two or three experiences or lessons that you mm-hmm. take from your practice environment into those discussions to turn the theoretical mm-hmm. into the actionable or the executable?
Well, I always say that I'm a clinician at heart. No matter what I'm doing now or have done, that's really where I come from, and that's my passion. So when I think about the lessons that I've learned from my training and how that impacts the work that I do, it's really been the ability to listen to people. Those are clinical skills that I learned that really do play out in the work that I do. Whether I'm, you know, meeting with other lobbyists or legislators or other advocates, being able to really listen to them. I used to joke that when I worked in the Capitol for a number of years, I felt like I did group therapy with lobbyists, bring people in from opposing sides.
I'm surprised you didn't say with legislators.
I wouldn't say that. bring people in from opposing sides and really come up with a solution. And I really saw the ability to utilize my clinical skills there. Not that I was providing them with any type of treatment, but just really understanding how people think, how they react, and being able to utilize that to come to a solution. One of the legislators I used to work for, one time he pulled me aside and said, this, you know, field and this field have been squabbling over this for 15 years. And I watched you in 15 minutes help them come up with a solution. That was amazing. How did you do that? And I said, I am a psychologist. I do have training that way. Like I said, I'll always be a clinician at heart, and I think there's always room for those skills to impact the advocacy work that I do.
So if you had a magic wand and could improve any part of the behavioral health system in California, what would be your number one priority in terms of, if we could do this one thing, it would make a demonstrable and observable difference in the quality of life for the people of California?
That is a tough question, because there's so much that needs to be done. But as I mentioned earlier, we're at a really great time right now. We have a great governor who's put a lot of energy into behavioral health and revamping the system. So if I had a magic wand, I think I'd focus on more public education around erasing stigma, which I think would also help impact health disparities. And so if money, if resources could be poured into educating people in a way that's culturally congruent for them about behavioral health and how to deal with it, I think that that's what I would really want to do. I think that would impact the system tremendously for everyone.
Incidentally, one of the other places where there's always a discussion about the nexus of behavioral health mm-hmm. with this condition is homelessness.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. there's been a lot of discussion, and frankly, a lot of resources, increasing amount of resources put forward, mm-hmm. related to that issue. Sure. Are we making progress?
I think so. In fact, the governor just appointed a task force on behavioral health and homelessness. And so there's a number of folks at the local level that are involved, local leaders. And so I'm very hopeful for the work that they're going to do. And because the governor comes from a background of being a mayor in San Francisco, there's definitely a focus for him on homelessness, and he's had to deal with that issue. And so I'm very hopeful. I think there's a lot of spotlight on the homeless population. Here in Sacramento, we have a mayor that's also very focused on the issue as well. And so I think the more attention that you pay to something like that, the more opportunity there is to discuss solutions. And so I'm very excited about the fact that we're talking about it. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck in your work.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. And that's our show. Thanks to our guest, and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. I'm Scott Syfax. See you next time right here on KVIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KVIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
For over 20 years, Five Star Bank has created thoughtful solutions to help the Capital Region thrive. From economic development and education to public health and safety, issues that are vitally important to Sacramento's prosperity. We're proud to be part of the conversation and hope you'll join in.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.